I want to begin with an illustration from the world of sports. Paul did that from time to time, and in his writing in the New Testament, Paul appealed to things to which his readers would have been familiar, including sporting events. Paul talks about running and wrestling and boxing and other kinds of things that would have been pretty familiar to his audience as illustrations of spiritual concepts. My illustration is a little bit different than that, but hopefully it'll be something that can help us. If you are a football fan at all, you may know the name of Jerry Rice. I know I'm dating myself by using Jerry Rice as an illustration. If you're over 40, I'm sure you know. But if you don't know who Jerry Rice is, let me enlighten you. Jerry Rice is one of the best wide receivers ever to play the game of football. He played for an almost unheard of 20 years in the National Football League. This was back during the 80s and 90s when Cowboys and the 49ers basically won all the time. He played for the San Francisco 49ers for almost all of his career. Jerry Rice went to 13 Pro Bowls, 3 Super Bowls, and has lots of all-time statistical records, some of which are still standing. But that's not really what I want to talk about. What's even more exceptional about that exceptional career is Jerry Rice's college background. A lot of the greats in the NFL went to major universities. Jerry Rice didn't. Jerry Rice's alma mater is Mississippi Valley State University, a small college in the rural South with a student body of fewer than 3,000. Rice could have gone to a prominent school. In fact, several of them were interested in him as he was coming out of high school. So why did he choose Mississippi Valley State, a small, obscure college that hardly anybody had heard of? Well, in an interview, Jerry Rice explained why. He said, "Out of all the big-time schools to recruit me, MVSU was the only school to come to my house and give me a personal visit. The big schools sent cards and letters and invitations to visit their campus. Mississippi Valley State sent their coach. He went to Rice's house, sat down with him, looked him in the eye, and said, 'Jerry, I need you. I believe you will make a difference in our program.' Only one school gave him personal attention. And Rice said that's what made all the difference." And that reminds me of the fact that a lot of times in life, there is just no substitute for personal attention, personal contact. In our business dealings, most of us, even pretty routine kinds of business dealings, most of us can relate to that. For example, when you call that company that you need to deal with, the cable company, the insurance company, really doesn't matter. And what do you have to do? You have to navigate a voice menu that obviously was designed to keep you from actually talking to a human being. I hate that. We all hate that. We want the personal contact of talking one-on-one to another person. It's bad enough that we have to do it over the phone, but then to have to navigate a bunch of computer menus tends to put us on the irritable side. Why? Because in business relationships, there's just no substitute for personal attention. And in the spiritual realm, there are a lot of applications to that very same principle. There is no substitute for personal contact. And there are a lot of ways in which I need to really think about whether I am paying careful enough personal attention to some of the people in my life. So I want to talk for a few minutes about some people who need, who deserve my personal attention based on what the Scriptures teach us. My responsibilities as a Christian include personal contact and involvement with people. And let's start with this one. The people who visit our assemblies need our personal attention. Have you ever gone and visited a congregation and just been more or less ignored? If so, then you understand the importance of this. I'd like you to think about something Paul introduces to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Understanding that this is a discussion of the proper use of the Corinthians' miraculous spiritual gifts in their assemblies. And you say, well, what does that have to do with talking to visitors? Well, here's what I want you to think about. In 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 24, Paul says, if all prophesy and an unbeliever or an ungifted man enters, he is convicted by all. He is called to account by all. In contrast, verse 23, he says, if the whole church assembles together and all speak in tongues, foreign languages, and ungifted men or unbelievers enter, will they not say that you are mad? Paul talks about the possibility that the Corinthians might have somebody come into their assembly who is not normally there, what we would call a guest, a visitor. In this case, he says somebody who either does not possess or is not familiar with miraculous spiritual gifts, or somebody who's an unbeliever and has no concept about those things. He says, if you are all speaking in foreign languages in your assembly and there's nobody to interpret, the person's going to conclude that you're all crazy. On the other hand, if there is prophecy taking place, real inspired instruction in this case, spoken in a language that people could understand, then hearts would be convicted, and even the person who is visiting would be affected by that. I just want you to see that Paul is concerned with the effect that the Corinthians' behavior in their assemblies might have on people who visited them. A passage that maybe speaks a little more directly to that is in James chapter 2. James chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. James says, my brethren, do not hold the faith of our glorious Lord Jesus with an attitude of personal favoritism or partiality. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who is wearing the fine clothes and say, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand over there, or you sit by my footstool, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? Partiality. The poor man in this illustration is ignored. He is dishonored. It matters how we treat one another. And in this case, it's manifest in the simple act of how these Christians were to greet someone and treat someone who came into their assembly. Let me make this suggestion for you. Do you see someone in the assembly who's a stranger? And I've got to be careful doing this because I know we have some folks who are visiting today, and I don't want to make any of you self-conscious when I say this. But if you see somebody in the assembly that you don't know, that you haven't met before, go meet them. Introduce yourself. Find out who they are. Invite them to come back. Invite them to lunch. Invite them to study. Personal interest opens doors of opportunity. Again, I want to be careful about that because I don't want the folks who are visiting us today to get trampled or suffocated by all the folks who are eager to carry this out. But I do like to see when we personally take an interest in people who have taken enough of an interest in spiritual things to visit our assemblies. Those people need my personal attention. And here's some other folks that need my personal attention. People who are lost need me to pay personal attention to them. That means I have to do more than, for example, sit in a Bible class and talk about how lost they are. I need to do something. There are many ways in which you can help reach the lost. In the book of Philippians, Paul writes to a church who had continual association with him in proclaiming the gospel. In fact, he gives thanks for their participation or their fellowship in the gospel with him in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 5. How had these people done that? This wasn't a church that was made up entirely of evangelists, so how was it that they had had sharing or participation with the Apostle Paul in preaching the gospel? Well, in this letter, he outlines a number of things that they did that helped in his preaching. They prayed for him. Verse 18, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Particularly what they were praying about was the situation of Paul in prison. These people prayed earnestly about the situation of this gospel preacher, and he acknowledged how helpful that was. But not only that, they extended him financial support. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 15. Paul says, "You yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs." And in the same chapter, Paul again talks about their ongoing concern for him. He knew that this was a group of people who day in and day out cared for and prayed for his welfare. So in verse 10 he says, "I rejoiced greatly in the Lord that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity." And in verse 14, "You have done well to share with me in my affliction." As a congregation, these people were doing those things, praying for Paul, supporting him, demonstrating their concern for him, and in that way, supporting the preaching of the gospel. To that extent, they were involved in it. And as vital as all of those things are, I want to suggest that there is probably more that I can do and that you can do. Because I know some lost people. And you know some lost people. There are people you work with, people in your family, people that you associate with in various organizations, people you play ball with, that you know are lost. What are you going to do about that? Those people need us to pay attention to them. They need us to talk to them and show kindness so that we can build bridges of trust with them. So that they will understand that we are interested in them, that we care for them. So that, for example, when a spiritual need arises in their life, when they have consciousness that there's something missing in their life, or it's just a problem, they will feel confident and secure and trusting in talking to us about it. And that can open a door of opportunity to talk to them about the gospel. To the extent that we have the ability, we need to make an effort to teach the lost people that we know lovingly and honestly, straightforwardly. And we need to make sure that our example matches the things that we teach. That's an important personal responsibility. That in our interactions with the people in our lives, we make sure we're living out the principle of the gospel that we're trying to teach them. So that we're not blinding them with our hypocrisy. And in all of that, we have to be willing to sacrifice the time and the energy and even the possible discomfort that comes from all of that. You see, as important as praying for and supporting evangelists is, this is another level of involvement in evangelism. This is a personal level. And so we risk personally. But that personal involvement is so important. I know I often say it, but I'll say it again. There may be somebody in your life who is lost, and you are in a better position to reach them with the gospel than anybody else in this world. Will you take a personal interest in that person? There are all kinds of biblical examples of people who took a personal interest in sharing the good news of the gospel with somebody in their life. In John chapter 1, beginning around verse 40, we read about Andrew encountering Jesus Christ. Who's the first person Andrew went and told? He found his brother Peter. And he said, "Come and see, we found the Messiah." A little bit later in that same chapter, Philip found someone he knew, Nathanael, said, we found the Messiah. Come and see." In John chapter 4, Jesus spoke at length with a Samaritan woman. And they talked about a number of things, and he declared to her in an uncharacteristically direct way that he was the Messiah, and said things to her that convinced her of the truth of that claim. And so in John chapter 4, we read about this Samaritan woman going back to her town and sharing her excitement with her neighbors, telling them, "Come see this man who told me all the things I ever did." In Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, after an angelic message, sent for Peter to come and preach. And when Peter arrived at Cornelius' house in Acts chapter 10 and verse 24, we find that Cornelius has called together all his relatives and close friends to hear the message of the gospel. And there are many more such examples. Examples where people encountered the message of truth and wanted to share it, and so they found somebody they knew, somebody they were close to, somebody with whom they had built a relationship, somebody who trusted them, and shared the message with them. That's personal involvement. And that is so important. That's why we so often refer to it as personal evangelism or personal work. Trying to talk to the people in our lives about the gospel. I know that we all have varying opportunities and varying abilities when it comes to that. I'm simply saying that we need to make better use of the opportunities and abilities that we have. Souls hang in the balance. Who needs my personal attention? People who are poor need my personal attention. In our society, there are lots of different ways in which people who are materially destitute can seek help. We have all kinds of federal, state, and local government programs that are designed to provide what we often call a social safety net for people of very low means. And then there are countless private organizations that work to help people in need. In terms of Christians in need, there are plenty of biblical examples of Christians in one place sending relief to brethren in other places. I think of Acts chapter 11. When the folks at Syrian Antioch heard a prophecy of an impending food shortage, one that was going to particularly be hitting hard their brothers and sisters in Judea, they determined to send relief to those brethren. And even among the believers in the church in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, we read about people selling houses and selling possessions of value so that that money could be used to provide for their brothers and sisters in need. And that's starting to get to what I really want us to think about. There are lots of ways in which we might be able to help people who are poor. In terms of just people in the world, I might decide to write a check to a charitable organization of some kind. If I'm just paying my taxes, I am in some way, some small way, contributing to some government program that might be designed to help those who are poor. But the biblical model of helping the poor is not limited to paying my taxes or writing a check to charity. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus depicts the scene of the judgment. He says in verse 31, "When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. And the King will say to those on His right, 'Come, you who are blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.' And the righteous will answer Him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you something to drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in? Or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?' And the King will answer and say to them, 'Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these My brothers, even the least of them, you did it to Me.'" So Jesus describes these people being commended, not just for having written a check, but for having involved themselves directly in meeting the needs of others. In James chapter 1, this is a passage we alluded to a couple of weeks ago. James chapter 1 and verse 27, James says that pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. I want you to think about that word "visit" that James uses for a minute. It means a lot more than just popping in and saying hello. The word that is used, that is translated visit there in other places in the New Testament, means to look upon or to look after, to inspect, to examine something or someone in order to determine the condition, to look upon in order to help or to benefit. One writer said that visiting in this sense requires three elements: personal contact, going to that needy person directly, personal examination, seeing to their needs, personal provision, providing for their needs. You want an example of the use of the word in Luke chapter 1 and verse 68, the prayer of Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for He has visited and redeemed His people. Does Zacharias mean God popped in and said, hey, how you doing? No. God had acted for the benefit of His people directly. Well, that's what James means when he talks about visiting orphans and widows in their distress as an example of people who might be in need. He goes on in chapter 2 and verse 15 and says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Our attitude toward those around us who are in need, and most especially our brothers and sisters who are in need, should be one of personal involvement. What commentator Marvin Vincent called personal contact with the world's sorrow. Virtually every day, you and I come to face with people who need help. We need to try to bring them face to face with mercy and compassion in the way we respond. Who needs my personal attention? Brothers and sisters who are hurting and struggling and discouraged need my personal attention. In Galatians chapter 6, Paul writes in verse 2, bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14, he says, we urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak. Be patient with all. There are countless ways to help somebody bear a burden who is emotionally distraught, somebody who is struggling in their faith, somebody who's just down and discouraged. Some words of sympathy or encouragement, maybe admonition or warning. Sometimes people just need a shoulder to cry on or somebody to talk to. Maybe a helping hand with a chore to lighten the load that someone is carrying for the day. Maybe a few minutes together in prayer. You can probably think of dozens of other things, dozens of other little ways in which we can help one another. Often the first and best thing you can do for somebody who is going through a difficult time is to be there. But do you see what that requires? You see what it requires to admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, and help the weak? I've got to be involved in that. It means I have to have contact with those people. I've got to be personally paying attention. And there's just no substitute for that. I'm the kind of person who, if you give me the choice between sending a card, making a phone call, or visiting face-to-face, I just prefer to talk to people face-to-face. I have never really liked talking on the phone to people because I can't see them. I can't pick up all those nonverbal cues. You know, it's hard for me. But when we need encouragement, some kind of personal contact, if all you can do is make a phone call, that's better than none. It's an effort to get involved in assisting somebody who is hurting or struggling or discouraged. The reason we have trouble with this is not hard to determine. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort and energy. And it forces us to choose to set aside other activities and priorities in order to make hurting, struggling, discouraged people a priority. It inconveniences us. And very often, that's the simple reason we are reluctant to do it. In fact, we could say that about a lot of the things on our list today. And yet, in order to fulfill the commands God has given us, in order to bless the people around us, this kind of personal attention is necessary. People in my family need my personal attention. We talked especially about parents and children 2 or 3 weeks ago. Money cannot take the place of conversation. Gifts are no substitute for companionship, whether you're talking about children or spouse or other people in your family that you have responsibilities to. We talk a lot, maybe not so much anymore, but I know for a long time, people made a big deal out of what we called quality time. And usually we made a big deal out of that to make up for the fact that the quantity of time people were spending with members of their family really wasn't very much. So it's quality time. I don't spend much time with them, but boy, when I do spend time with them, man, it's great. And there's nothing wrong with what we call quality time, but I want to suggest that the quantity of time, the amount of time you spend with someone, says a great deal more about how much you value them. Proverbs chapter 15. In Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16, Solomon writes, "Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred." You see the picture of family life in those verses. The picture of a home that may not have very much in terms of material things, but a family that fears God and loves one another. And the consistent message of Scripture, not just here in Proverbs 15, but in both Old and New Testaments, is that godliness and love among a family is far more important than the amount of stuff that we have. And again, this is a subject we talked about recently, so I won't say too much more about it. But the people in my family need my personal attention. My children do, my spouse does. They don't just need the things that I can provide for them. They need me. Your family needs you. And again, in some cases, realizing that and making that happen may mean a reordering of priorities. In which case, I say, let the reordering begin. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. You might be able to think of other examples, other people who need our personal attention. What all of this, I hope, makes us realize is that discipleship is not merely something that we sit back and believe, nor is it merely a list of evil things that we're supposed to not do. Discipleship is also things that we are actively to pursue, and many of those things involve the other people in our world. People who visit us, people who are lost, people who are needy, people who are hurting, people who are in our families, they all need us to pay attention to them. They all need personal contact and involvement from us if we are going to carry out our responsibilities to them, responsibilities that God has laid on us. It bears repeating, there is just no substitute for personal attention. Especially in an era in which technological tools to manage our time and our resources and our communication often have the ironic effect of making us more and more isolated from each other. Whether someone is lost or needy or hurting, whether they are someone we know well or someone we just met, the personal attention we give them, the way in which we demonstrate our commitment to Christ and His love, can make all the difference. Think about the difference it made in your life when someone took the time to share with you the good news of the gospel. Maybe there are many people in your life that would fit that description. Aren't you grateful? Don't you want to be that kind of person in someone else's life? And think again about the fact that Jesus, the Son of God, takes a personal interest in each and every one of us. Demonstrated that in the most profound way when he emptied himself and took on the form of a bondservant and humbled himself even to the point of death on a cross, as Paul writes in Philippians 2. That was not God making a social call. That was God acting for our benefit. Christ's visit to men, one writer said, was God's personal contact and inspection to oversee our great need for salvation from sin. And He personally provided the redemption price to meet that need. He did that for me, and He did that for you. We're going to sing a song in just a moment that I hope will encourage you if you have not yet responded to that gracious offer of salvation. I hope will encourage you to make that step today.